want to say one thing. I guess I didn't realize, although everybody else and their mother probably knows this, but I didn't realize that Chaucer had actually raped a woman or been charged with raping a woman. It devastated me. Not, I mean, obviously because, you know, I love the Canterbury Tales, but I'm just finding myself very distressed about this historical reality of men doing this to women. And I'm very disturbed about that, this phenomenon. And
I actually did not know about the rape. I didn't. I did not find out until you told me this very moment. I did not know that.
Well, I was reading some secondary sources, and it was like, what?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You were going to say.
So I take it that he was accused and that they settled it or something? That's my understanding of what happened.
He was accused. I'm not sure about the result. Maybe that wasn't the result, but I know he was.
I don't know.
He wasn't convicted.
I'm having a hard time squaring that. With everything that I've just read, I'm having a hard time squaring the person and the voice that you hear in these tales with someone who would actually rape. So I don't know. It doesn't feel...
Do you want my take on all this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So my take is that, I don't know, we're kind of jumping into, like, the weeds. I don't know. There's, number one, it's kind of hard to come to a conclusion based on, like, a random record that basically all we know about is the settlement document, I believe. And I don't know how, I don't know basically whether, you know, the sort of default assumption that we would make now that any accusation would probably be likely to be credible, be the same at the time. I know.
Wait, what do you mean?
Meaning that I'm not sure that the legal system was as reliable back then. But I think there might
have
been more false accusations generally.
Yeah, I think it was records are kind of like I'm reading this one thing that says, you know, it could have been an abduction versus a rape. And it was like, it's not exactly clear what it was.
But that's not to say that he didn't do it. I'm just saying that it's hard to kind of reconstruct it. But I think this is one of these things where because of the strong emotions involved, one wants to resolve the fact of the matter one way or the other definitively, and it's just kind of something that can't really...
Except that there are a number of scholars who think that he wrote maybe a portion of The Wife of Bath's Tale and another tale, I'm not sure which, to assuage his guilt.
Yeah, I mean, that might be the case. It's certainly weird that he would be, I think it was in 1380 that he was accused, and he's probably writing Wife of Bath by at least 1390. And it certainly is weird that one would write such a thing. I don't know. You could read it two ways, right? You could read it that if he's going to write basically, you know, a story that is very much sort of, you know, about rape, that why would someone who actually committed a rape want to do that? You could read it the other way, that exploring the experience that he was, you know, trying to, you know, as you said, assuage guilt or understand what he had learned or something. I don't know. I mean, I think it's one of these things where you want to grasp at, you want to tell a story that makes him either a good guy or a bad guy, and wrap it all up with the story, and I don't think that's possible.
I don't know if that's the case, because I didn't read anything about that, and I, Seth Lehrer is a sort of a scholar of Chaucer, and when he describes The Wife of Bath and sort of why he wrote it and things like that, it makes much more sense to think of it in literary terms versus, like, this other thing that you're bringing up now. I don't know. It doesn't seem really legitimate. It seems like in modern times, it's a huge overreach, because like in 1300, even if he did rape, I don't know. I just don't know. It doesn't seem, it seems a bit far-fetched that he would have done that.
The flip side is that it's, I don't know. I get the sense that he was married, but he fucked around a lot. And well, I wouldn't be surprised if one of these things went wrong. And
let me just say this. I read this, and it's from Wikipedia, so take it with whatever you want to take it with. But it says that there's a scholar, George, I can't remember his name, suggests that The Wife's Tale may have been written to ease Chaucer's guilty conscience. It is recorded that in 1380, associates of Chaucer stood surety for an amount equal to half of his yearly salary for a charge brought by Cecily Champagne for
to pay a lot of money for the settlement.
Yeah, for a derapto rape or abduction. Right. So that's where the abduction, and the same view has been taken of his legend of good women, which Chaucer, this tale or his story, which Lost Chaucer himself describes, he wrote as a penance.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, so he wrote Troilus and Cressida in 1386.
Right.
Cressida is a sort of psychological portrait of Cressida, and, you know, she ultimately kind of betrays Troilus, right? Mm-hmm. And his kind of fictional explanation for the legend of good women is supposedly, I think it was the queen, like, responded to him that, oh, you know, you wrote about, you're slandering us with Cressida, you have to write about good women now. And so he began writing the legend of good women. He kind of, I think, gave that up sometime in the mid-1380s. And at that point, he began Canterbury Tales. I mean, the weird thing about the whole kind of rape thing is that he's also often taken as a sort of proto-feminist.
Right. But also, so,
to be honest, I don't think the inquiry as to, like, the meaning of his alleged rape in connection with his work, like, is terribly
except simple. That it, well, maybe. I mean, except that it has been pointed out by these scholars. No, but it's curious because, I mean, that time period obviously is famous for high anti-feminism or misogyny, actually. I mean, in ancient and medieval literature and time. So it is curious that he had this sort of proto-feminist perspective, but then is, you know, has been charged with this rape. It makes you wonder about the difference between the art that someone creates and the life that they live.
Well, I also think that people are complicated and that
in our
ideological time that we want artists to be either good or bad, and I don't think
it's not possible.
Productive way of looking at it. So in any event, the reason that I chose Chaucer is basically because I think his work is very much about a world that is falling apart, the medieval world, in a time of the Black Death. You know, he lived at a time when the English nation was kind of coming together but also falling apart. But basically, you know, there was a 100 years war. There were some initial victories in the 1350s. It all seemed like a great opportunity. But, you know, basically, England by the end of the 14th century was falling apart politically. And also the Great Schism in the church, where there were essentially two popes.
Like we have now.
Yeah. So I kind of find myself obsessed with him because he's very much relevant to our world, which feels like it's falling apart and at the same time feels like it might jump into a completely different thing. I mean, that's the other aspect about Chaucer, that he kind of recognizes that a new world is coming. Canterbury Tales very much about that post-feudal world. So let me step back a bit. The basic premise of the book is that it is told ostensibly from the perspective of Chaucer himself. There's a narrator named Chaucer, essentially. And he talks about how he was going to go on a pilgrimage from London, where he lived, to Canterbury, where there's the Canterbury Cathedral, where St. Thomas Becket was killed famously by the king. And on his way, he stopped at a tavern just outside of London, and he basically ran into this huge group of, I think, 28 or 29 fellow pilgrims. He kind of fell in with them. And the tavern host there proposes, you know, he says, oh, I'll go along with you. And he proposes a sort of tale-telling game where everyone would tell four tales, two on the way there, two on the way back. And he would pick the best one, and the winner would get a feast paid for by the rest of the pilgrims. And they all agree to this deal. And so the rest of the book is basically the people telling their tales on the way to Canterbury. They don't end up, you don't end up getting four tales from each one. It's, you know, at most one tale. It's kind of mysterious as to whether it was left unfinished or it seems, but, you know, there's also some hints that
elsewhere in the text that it was more or less finished, and they, like, somewhere along the way, people just decided that there were just too many tales, and they would just tell one tale. So what we decided to do here, because it's a long-ass book, just read the general prologue and three of the tales, what I regard as the three best tales, the Miller's Tale, the Wife of Bath's Tale, and the Partner's Tale, along with the prologues. So, now, just to give a little bit of a biography of Chaucer, I'm not sure our pre-show discussion is going to, you know, if any of it's going to go into the final version, but, you know, Chaucer was born to a middle-class wine trader in London as a result of the Black Plague, which killed about 40 to 60% of the population in the mid-14th century and kind of coming back a few years. There were a lot of openings. As a teenager, he had an opportunity to work for the royal family, which he took. And the rest of his life, he was basically working at various jobs for the royal family as a sort of, you know, executive or something. I mean, he was like a diplomat at times. He worked overseeing customs, which was a major source of tax revenue because England's major export was wool. He married, he had a few kids, but he lived separately from his wife almost his entire life. He had, as a sort of diplomat, he went to early Renaissance Italy, Florence, Milan, etc., to negotiate loans and get ships and stuff like that for their Hundred Years' War. It's thought that he had an opportunity to get, you know, books by Boccaccio and Dante. He often refers to Dante. As a general historical background point, you have to recognize that everyone's heard of the Norman invasion, okay? Like, it's basically happened in 1066. It was the French basically invading England, taking it over. So you had this French overclass and a sort of, you know, middle class slash under, you know, lower class, which was itself a mix of Anglo-Saxon and the Celts who were there prior to when the Anglo-Saxons invaded. It was basically a world where there was an upper class that was very much French, spoke French, and a lower class that was spoke English. And basically, it was kind of a strange thing, right, in English at the time. It was basically the language of kind of normal people.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but wasn't that one of the greatest things about Canterbury Tales is that it established English as one of the, or the language of sort of popular literature?
Yeah, I mean, and he's writing about the middle class itself. So this is like writing about the middle class, strata of the middle class, in their own language. But you have to also recognize that one of the things about the Hundred Years' War was essentially a French civil war with this ruling class in England claiming right. that it was the rightful kings of France, essentially. And in order to whip up sentiment to advance their interests, they also tried to create a sense of English nationalism. They said things like, If we lose this war, the French will come and they'll make you speak French. It's an interesting dynamic. It was basically a time when, you know, English was coming into its own as a literature. And you also have to recognize English is this bizarre sort of Creole language that's really a combination of, you know, the Anglo-Saxon kind of Germanic elements, which kind of form the more functional words, and then French. Borrowed from the Norman French, which kind of are the fancy words, and with the kind of the Viking Germanic language also thrown in.
And that's what makes essentially what we consider Middle English, which is what Canterbury Tales are written in.
Yeah. But you have to recognize that all these, I mean, what the difference between Middle English and Modern English is just more or less that you see the scene in the Creole language more.
Right.
I mean, it's an interesting, I feel like it's kind of an interesting exercise besides literary quality is just to kind of of understanding where our language comes from, that it's this bizarre kind of, you know, it's almost like Spanglish, right? Like, it is Spanglish.
Yeah, it is kind of like that.
But anyway, back to the story. I'm going on a digression. So, just to kind of jump through, you know, the general prologue, the bulk of it is spent explaining who everyone is. Not sure I'll go through each and every one, but there's kind of maybe three or four main groups. There's a group of fighters like the knight and his squire and a yeoman. There's clergy. There's like a prioress. There is a friar. There's a monk. Then there's a bunch of people who have sort of practical jobs, like a merchant and a law, wealthy farmer, physician. Oh, yeah. Of the clergy, a notable one is a parson. And, you know, and then there's kind of like a lower class element. There's like a shipkeeper. There's a cook. So there's like a lower middle class contingent as well. So I think the way that we should go about doing this is to kind of take them in sections rather than kind of throw them all together, because they're all kind of their own beasts. And, you know, maybe at the end you could draw connections, but I think it's best to handle these one by one. My overall impression of the general prologue is that it sets up Chaucer as a narrator as being like an idiot, and which is actually something you see in his writing generally, is that it's, you know, it's told from supposedly Chaucer's perspective, but, you know, the Chaucer that he represents himself as being is like an idiot. Like, he can't, you recognize quickly you can't really trust his judgment. He's basically an unreliable narrator, and particularly unreliable in matters of actually kind of figuring things out. He kind of just reports things. And where you see this especially is that, so he starts off describing the knight, kind of a straight ahead description of this sort of, you know, somewhat old fashioned chivalric knight. You know, then you're like, okay, fine, this is pretty straightforward. He moves on to the pride, then something seems a little bit off. She's kind of this kind of fussy woman that doesn't seem so religious. She seems more kind of status oriented. A prioress, I think, being the head of like a group of nuns, basically, I think. You know, it seems a little bit off, like, okay, fine, maybe she's not the greatest Christian, but doesn't seem like a horrible person. But then he goes on to, I think he talks about a monk who likes to go hunting and a friar who seems like a kind of social butterfly. But I think it's really the monk where you kind of realize that something is kind of off, because the monk doesn't seem properly religious at all. He just kind of likes to go hunting and to have fun. And this is, I think, the critical quote. This monk, like, old things were his pace and held after the new world the space. He's basically a playboy who is living as a monk, just as sort of like a
pauper.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the thing where he's not really doing monkly duties. He's just sort of living off of the money that he gets as a monk and does kind of fun stuff. You know, it's really this kind of suggestion here that there's a new world coming about that is kind of completely lost its sort of bearings in medieval morality. And you see this over and over again in throughout the book, that there's these just kind of scathing attacks on the clergy. I think that's like just a sustained kind of pattern in the book. And I think I think critics kind of generally acknowledge this, but they kind of...
The breakdown of the religious structures in the Middle Ages?
Yeah, well, that particularly saying? The church is just totally corrupt. But the interesting thing about, in terms of the general prologue and the unreliable narrator bit, is that Chaucer, the narrator, says, yeah, this guy was awesome. He was such a cool guy. He went out and he was this monk who just, like, said, fuck religion and, like, go and hunt and do cool things. You know, there's a quote later on. What should he study and make himself? Why should he study it and make himself mad on a book in a cloister, or work with his hands and labor, as St. Augustine bid him to do? How shall the world be served by doing that? I'm basically doing a little impromptu translation here, and Chaucer, the narrator, says, you know, let St. Augustine have his work to him reserved. Chaucer, the narrator, is endorsing this idea of a new world where, you know, who cares about religion? Like, maybe we keep the old forms, But, you know, we don't really take them terribly seriously. But, like, within a few pages later, he reaches the parson. You know, he's going through this list and describing each of the pilgrims. And he reaches the parson. And the parson is completely different. The parson is like an honest God, kind of old-fashioned Christian who just is watching after his flock. It's like everything that a Christian priest should be. And, like, weirdly, Chaucer, the narrator, then approves of that, too. There's a contradiction between his approval of the monk and his approval of the parson as well. There's various other... I think that's very explicit, that there's a contradiction there that Chaucer, the narrator, doesn't really recognize, and you get a sense. I think the close reader...
Yeah, but isn't that a reasonable conflict to have? I mean, obviously the church is corrupt, and he's laying that out when he discusses the monk, but maybe because he's being sort of more in terms of the parson and not like saying, well, that this is crazy or something. Maybe that's the conflict that exists within the whole society at the moment, that yes, we want to stay with the church and we want to stay with religion. We want to stay with Jesus, whatever, but the institution is corrupt. It's like that internal conflict, right?
I mean, I think if you would want to say the parson is good, you would want to say the monk is bad. And if you want to say the monk is good, you would have to say the parson is just kind of silly.
I think you could have some sort of logically cohesive way to connect the two. Like if you just thought, the monk, obviously religion's corrupt, it's all a sham, the monk's doing the best he can by doing this weird stuff, but the parson, as a true believer, kind of living his truth, then that's all right too.
That's relativism. But the thing is that what he...
It's not an impossible position to hold. I feel like I, you know, sometimes, if you want to accuse me of stooping to relativism, you know, I'm not religious, but if that's, you know, how people live their lives, I'm totally for it. And if, I think it's weird if you were a priest and, like, stealing things and shooting around, but good for you as well.
No, well, that's the kind of attitude. You know, what I'll at least say is that this sort of more practical-oriented kind of, you know, kind of relativism of kind of live and let live, you know, it's not something that really is, it's very much of the new world, right? It's not like the medieval Dante account of how you should think about the world. So that you have these kind of tensions between the morals of the different, of various different pilgrims, and he kind of weirdly approves them all in a sort of live and let live kind of way, not really kind of recognizing the tensions between all their kind of different worldviews. And there's one other thing that...
I just want to interrupt because I think that's a really interesting point. And I just want to think that also it's mirrored, obviously, in the characters themselves and the stories they tell. I read the three that you had talked about, and I read a couple others, and the kind of moral tone or even what you're supposed to get out of the story varies, I feel, incredibly widely. Like, there's no cohesive moral tale throughout all of them, I think.
Well, that's kind of the mystery that's set up by the text, I think, of, like, is there a way to kind of reconcile this all, or is there a kind of larger point or unity to all these different tales? And, you know, Chaucer, the narrator, kind of pretend, you know, it's just kind of like a dunce. I mean, I think, and he basically said, you know, by having this dumb narrator, he's basically saying, I'm not going to try to help you construct what all these things are going to mean together. It's kind of something for you to do on your own. And, you know, it's totally unclear to me whether Chaucer had a larger point in, you know, putting all these tales together, whether there was some sort of larger architectural sort of structure that he was going at. But, you know, just to go to this unreliable narrator thing again, I think it's particularly interesting. At one point in the general prologue, he says that basically... you know, Chaucer, the narrator, he basically says that his examples, you know, that he's going to straight talk kind of, you know, he's going to talk straight, kind of not just be deceptive. And he says his examples here are Christ and Plato. Christ spake himself full broad and holy writ, and well ye would nobility is it. Plato saith, whoso can him read, the words most both be cousin to the deed. So it's really funny that he's saying that, like, what he's saying here is, like, his basic point in this little bit is that I'm just reporting what people are saying, and don't blame me if it is ugly or bad or immoral or something like that. And it's weird that his two examples of what he's doing here are Christ and Plato, because Christ spoke in parables and Plato often spoke in, you know, allegories, basically. Quote that he's taking this Plato bit from is from the Timaeus, which was commonly read as an allegorical dialogue. It's the one with the demiurge and all this kind of this. So you have this narrator who says, I'm going to give it to you straight. His examples seem like Chaucer, the actual poet, saying, actually, this isn't straight, right? Does that make sense, basically?
That it isn't straight?
Yeah, that basically, I think Chaucer, his actual authorial intent was to make you think that, like, you know, this isn't really a straight ahead book, that there's kind of an esoteric sort of meaning here.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to me that you describe him as sort of an ignorant or unreliable or dense narrator.
Yeah, I agree.
I didn't necessarily get that. I sort of saw it as, you know, he's taking this cross-section of the population, all different levels of society interacting, and he's using language and he's using poetry to tell a lot about that particular swath of society. So the prioress, who is supposed to be the head of a convent, is she's described as, you know, as being very proper in her manners, but these were the way that courtesans or, you know, prostitutes were taught in that time. She's very eroticized throughout that. And then, you know, various other people in the prologue are described in these physical ways. And the physical description is sort of a stand-in for like a moral description. It's not a straightforward story in the sense that what you see is what you get. You kind of have to understand what the subtext is. I didn't necessarily see him as, well, I'm just wondering, where did you get, like, why is he, I know he's unreliable, but I'm
like, this is a bit unfair, but, you know, it's partly because of greater context of having read the whole thing. It, like, when you get to Chaucer's tale, it's like this ridiculous, horrible poem. He's basically doing like a send-up of himself, right? Where Chaucer, the narrator here, has like the worst single tale to the point where the people like tell him to stop. The other reason I'm saying this is partly because in his other poems, he has a similar sort of stupid guy persona. And it's interesting because like he literally took a deposition once. They have a record of a deposition and he had a similar sort of like stupid guy persona where what his points were in the deposition, they were very much sort of between the lines in the same way. So I think that this was sort of like his shtick, basically. So, you know, he wanted to, when he would want to kind of suggest dangerous things, he acted dumb, basically.
It seems like what you're saying is that this sort of, I can't possibly be saying anything of real importance because I'm such a fool. But if you're smart, you'll get the subtext. And like, he's like using this as sort of a protection for himself to really make really racy statements about mankind at the time.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's what I'm getting at.
14th century Alex Jones defense that he
had. Yeah.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, in a sense, yes. The other thing, I mean, he was kind of somewhat, I mean, ultimately Chaucer watched out for himself, is my sense. Chaucer cared about Chaucer, but it's interesting to note that he was kind of aligned with a guy named John of Gaunt, who was this rich royal who himself had, he did not seem, I'll just put it this way, that he seemed to be Machiavellian in his tactics. John of Gaunt would be a sort of proto-Machiavellian guy. So there was at the same time a movement called the Lollards that were trying to get the Bible translated into English and to have a sort of Protestant revolution 100 years before the actual Protestant revolution. And it's often thought that perhaps Chaucer was somewhat aligned with the Lollards, or like literally in the guy who wrote Fox's Book of Martyr, the actual Fox guy, thought that Chaucer was a kind of crypto Lollard. And I mean, I think this might sound conspiratorial, but I don't know whether he was a crypto Lollard or what, but I do think he was in this book. He is a crypto something or other, and it's kind of a mysterious what exactly he is trying to get across. Whether, and I think it can really range a lot in that scholars haven't really fully appreciated how much, you know, it could be what he's getting at, how much it could vary. For all I know, it could be a different version of Christianity. I think it might very well be, I mean, it could be orthodoxy. I don't know. It could be, let's go back to the Middle Ages view of things. But I also think it could possibly be sort of like a proto atheism, really. I mean, I think you could just as easily view this as being the forerunner of Hobbes and Spinoza. These are very serious attacks on the church that he's making, and I don't know whether, you know, you could read them as just sort of being a good Christian wanting the clergy to go back to being good clergy. I think you could just as easily read them as being a complete attack on religion, and I know scholars really hate this idea that how could Chaucer be against the church, but I think it's an honest, open question. I don't know. What other things did people note about the general prologue or anything like that?
Yeah, I don't know that I have much more to say about the prologue. I also had the same concern that Jennifer and Laura did.
What I thought about the prologue was, you know, I read through them all, and, you know, they were interesting, whatever, but I focused on the section, the lines that would relate to the actual tales that we read.
Yeah, so let's go to the Miller tale. In any event,
I think we're waiting for your comment.
Oh, sure. What?
No, we're silent this entire time.
Nathan's comment.
Yeah, no, oh, sorry.
No, okay. I think we are ready to move on. It was a general sketch. I didn't find anything outside of context in it worth mentioning, you know, really. And your elaboration that this is a kind of authorial character wasn't clear to me either, outside of his addressing, you know, in the usual way of like, I'm just telling the story as best I can, you know, please pardon me, or if I can't get all the accuracies. That seemed common, you know, like a Frankenstein trick or anything else. But I can take your point that this is to be viewed with like a lens of, if not satire, then I don't know, some kind of guile. The stories themselves we can talk about, because I think there is something clearly approaching like a worldview or at least morality. At least there seems to be a clear morality within the stories. The Miller, I think, is actually, like, we'll see, but the least interesting to me. It just seems like a dirty joke, but we can talk about it.
Sure. Okay, so let me briefly explain the Miller's Tale. This is a little bit of background. It's a bit of a, you know, the Knight's Tale is basically about these two knights fighting for this woman. And the Miller's Tale is a weird, he comes right after. He literally interrupts the order of the tale telling and says, oh, I want to tell my tale now. He basically tells a sort of parody of the Knight's Tale, the Knight's Tale being this kind of high gloss, noble kind of tale of men fighting for this highborn woman. And in the Miller's Tale, it's two young men fighting to have sex with this carpenter's wife. Basically, the story of a carpenter, John, his wife, Allison, and two young men, they're fighting over the opportunity to have sex with the wife, basically. The first of the young men is a guy named Nicholas. He's a student. He's a boarder at the carpenter's house. And one day when the carpenter is gone, John basically makes a move on Allison and they have sex. Shortly thereafter, Allison goes to work where he's seen by the other young man at issue here. His name is Absalom. I guess he's a sort of a priest in training. Absalom apparently likes to fuck women a lot also. I mean, I think that's suggested. And he starts to be obsessed with Allison as he sees her there in church. Allison rebuffs his advances, though. In any event, the carpenter comes back. Nicholas begins scheming as to how he can have sex with Allison again. He hatches a scheme where he pretends to have a vision from God of Noah's flood coming back. And he tells the carpenter that the carpenter needs to, because the flood is coming back, he needs to prepare and hang three tubs from the ceiling with a rope so that when the flood comes, the carpenter can cut the rope and the three tubs will drop into the water and they'll be saved, like Noah, right? Like Noah's Ark. This carpenter, I guess, you know, stupidly goes along with this plan, kind of caught up in the kind of religious rhetoric that Nicholas uses. And then on the night when Nicholas says the flood will happen, the carpenter goes to bed in his
you know, all three of them go to bed in different tubs. And after the carpenter is asleep, Nicholas sneaks out and goes into Allison's tub, and they have sex. After they have sex, with the carpenter still asleep and it's still being night, Absalom, this other young man who wants to have sex with Allison, comes to the window of the house and asks Allison for a kiss. She now says she'll do it and opens the window, but instead of giving him a kiss, she sticks out her ass, and because it's dark, Absalom kisses Allison's ass. Angry at being fooled, Absalom then gets a red-hot poker from a blacksmith and comes back. Absalom then stands at the window, asks for another kiss, and Nicholas, you know, the other young man, wants to play the same trick. He sticks his ass out the window and farts. At that point, Absalom sticks the red-hot poker in Nicholas's ass. Nicholas runs around in the house screaming for water, which wakes up the carpenter, who, of course, hears water, 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 and thinks, oh my God, Noah's flood has returned. At that point, the carpenter cuts the rope. All the tubs come crashing down. The townspeople, hearing noise, they rush in. The carpenter tells his whole story about Noah's flood, but Allison and Nicholas say he's just mad, and the townspeople believe he's just mad. The end. You know, it's like...
I loved it with the tubs. I just love that. It's just insane.
So this one we read in the modern English, but in the original version, the carpenter mistakes Noah's flood for Noella's flood, which is interesting that they left that out of the. Did you guys know that? Did you read that or find that out? Did anybody else?
No.
What I'm trying to say is that the original, he mistakes Noah's flood and he doesn't call it that. He calls it something else, which is incorrect. He just basically misunderstood or misheard. And so I think the point in the story is that, like, everything is misunderstood. They kiss an ass instead of lips. They, you know, all of these, he hears water, which is meant to be for his hot ass that has just been poked.
Yeah,
Then everything is sort of inverted and messed up and, like, said the wrong way. And I think that's just sort of the point of this. It's not just funny, but there's, like, a larger message here about the misunderstanding. And the way things are, and the story starts out with, like, the next person who's supposed to go according to sort of social hierarchy is this one guy, and this Miller, like, no, I'm going to leave, you don't let me do it, and whatever. And then I don't know if you guys know about the Peasants' Revolt of 1381, which is during that time period. So I think that kind of plays a role in the story. And so do you have any thoughts along those lines?
You know, I think a very important line from this tale, line 262 and 263, was, ignorant men are truly blessed, believing only what they believe and knowing what they know. I think that says a lot about what happens in this tale, like kissing her ass, singing into her lips. Ignorant men are truly blessed, believing only what they believe. It's line 262.
Right. So, I just meant they call it in the original.
I have it open.
It's different numbering, but it's Noella's blood versus the original Noah's blood.
The argument for that? I mean, what are you saying?
It's just that he doesn't get what it's like a misunderstanding of the biblical story. And I just felt like, oh, that's part of what he's trying to say in this, is that there's a general misunderstanding of what the morality of sort of religion is at the time. Do you know what I mean? Like they're just kind of like off track. I don't know.
Yeah, I know. I know what you're saying here. I forget where the section is in particular, but he kind of goes off. The carpenter kind of goes off on a rant where he kind of betrays, even though he's kind of caught up in this religious illusion, he kind of betrays his utter sort of ignorance of actual religion. I forget where this section is. But anyway, I take your point. I forget whether it was exactly misunderstanding what Noah's flood is or whatever, but I think that is.
I think it's like in the 300s in this one. I don't want to dwell on it. I just thought that, like, when I first read it, I too thought it was just this guy wanted to tell this kind of crass story and get a laugh out of everyone. And I feel like that's sort of the MO of Chaucer, is that, you know, on the face of things, that it's very a specific way. Like, it's just this funny story, and this, you know, this carpenter is made a fool of because he's an idiot and his wife is screwing around on him and they're in this marriage and he's a moron for marrying an 18-year-old, and he's this old guy, and I kind of get this feeling, and I don't feel like I have the wherewithal skill to properly fully get it, but I think he's trying to say something else here. I don't think it's only this. And I'm like, okay, what is he trying to say here? What is his commentary on life using this vehicle of the Miller's Tale?
I think there's a quote here. I mean, so when I was reading this, I was reading the Middle English version. I apologize if this causes confusion, but the thing I have open here is the Middle English version. So I try to just translate as I go along. You know, there's a quote right after Nicholas gives the whole spiel about Noah's flood coming, where the miller says, "Lo, what a great thing is emotion. Men may die of imagination. So deep may an impression be taken. This silly carpenter beginneth to quake. Him thinketh verily that he thinks that Noah's flood is actually going to come back and drown Allison, his honey dear. He weeps, he wails, he sighs and groans." To my mind, this is another example of Chaucer pointing out the ways that religion can be misused and showing sort of, I think his suggestion here is that, like, to send up people who are dupes and can be manipulated through religion. I mean, I think that there's a suggestion here of that.
I agree. I think it's, you know, I wonder what was the purpose of, I mean, I don't know if there was a purpose, but what was the purpose of having, you know, them sort of sleeping high in these tubs and then them sort of, I think there was a correlation somewhere in, I don't know, some sort of secondary literature somewhere that this was related to sort of the fall of man, and the falling from the rafter, the tub was symbolic of the fall of man.
Well, so perhaps that's the case. But the thing that connected it with was, I think Noah's flood is an easy target that people won't look askance at for him to make a parody of. It's kind of a silly, everyone kind of agrees it's maybe a little bit of a silly story. But what I think is real target here is really like Revelation. Really the whole kind of idea of the Christian afterlife, which Noah's flood is taken as being a sort of allegory for in the allegorical reading of the Hebrew Bible that the Christians did. And sort of the idea that there's this elect who will be saved. And I mean, in what we have here, I think, is a sort of, I mean, he has like a very, it's basically like an account of how the church goes about kind of manipulating people in a way that puts into question a sort of fundamental doctrine of Christianity. And the fall of the tubs is the fall of man. If that is a connection, what do you think is the implication of that connection? The illusion was lost. I see what you're saying. That when the tubs fell, it was like the illusion of the Garden of Eden, like this kind of world without knowledge.
Well, I didn't actually think that right away. When I first read it, I was kind of like in the same boat as Nathan. I was just like, this is sort of a funny joke, and I don't really get the point of it. I mean, I could tell right off the bat when we read the prologue, okay, he's going to be making some commentary about the social order, you know, and how that all works together. He's going to have all these people interacting that are all in different social classes, and he's going to ruffle some feathers. And so when I read The Wife of Bath and I kind of went back and looked at this one that I'm like looking at, you know, okay, so we've got this husband who is sort of arguably the more higher status of the group. Is that correct? Do you think that that's like how he's portrayed? He's older, he's wiser, he's
younger. I think that's fair to say.
Like, I don't know the social status of things, but it seems like Nicholas is a bit of an errand boy, you know?
Yeah, he's some sort of student. He seems like kind of just a young, stupid kid.
Yeah, and so he gets the better of the husband, and the husband's the buffoon all the way through the story. And meanwhile, the woman is largely in control. I mean, it's interesting.
She doesn't get a comeuppance here, too. I mean, nothing bad really happens to her.
She doesn't, and it starts out that, like, she's kind of getting, I don't know, is she getting raped, or she's getting, like, groped or something by Nicholas, right?
And then like a total weird thing at the beginning.
Right.
Like the way that Nicholas comes on to her and just apparently grabs her crotch.
Yeah, like literally. Her crotch. Yeah, like that. Like, I think they don't use such nice terms for it in the original. But then she sort of I don't remember what she did, but I just remember reading it and feeling like, oh, she kind of got her. She was like, no, I don't think so. And then he started to speak in this way that was apparently very, it worked on her. She was very charmed by him, and she ended up loving him and like being madly in love with him. And so Absalom, he kind of looks like an ass too, because he's also a bit of a higher station than Nicholas, right? Is that right?
Well, I mean, he seems to be in training to be a priest or something, so.
Yeah, I couldn't really, I don't know, I got the idea that he was, I don't know if it was something about the way that he was described and the way he looked, but he also seemed a bit more proud, less errand boy-y, and then he's made a fool of. And, you know, in the end, Nicholas gets his ass poked with a hot poker, but, I mean, he does kind of get a lot of what he wants, but then the only person that really never, which is throughout this book, or I don't know what the book, but throughout the things we read, the only one who never really gets, like you said, their comeuppance is her. Like, she, nothing happens to her. She, you know, her husband is sort of none the wiser, and she doesn't get her ass poked with a hot poker. So, I mean, there's a lot of things in there that have to do with, to me, like ruffling up the feathers of the social order of things.
Yeah.
And then I felt like the use of Noah's Ark and all of that, it just felt like, the only way I can describe it is, it just felt like really making fun of people who buy into this shit. You know what I mean? Like, it just used it. He just used it as like a, I don't know. He mocked it. He mocked it in a way. And when I heard that in the original, I was that he was mistaking the Noahs for Noelis. It was as though the people who have read the Bible or are into it have sort of missed the point of it.
Yeah.
And they don't understand, you know, the real meaning of it, but they're full of this sort of, the ideas that you're going to be doing. Like, it's very, they're missing the spirit of it, like, yeah, missing the point of it, versus, and just thinking, okay, like, this is what we have to do this, and then we'll get on to the Noah's Ark and we'll be fine, and very sort of, pragmatic about the way they follow God and not really, but they're missing the point in all of it.
Yeah. Like, religion is sort of magic to them. And magic that gets you practical benefits. It's not like this.
But they're not good deep down inside. They're just, yeah, buffoons trying to like follow these rules, and they're missing it completely.
Yeah. Don't you get a sense that Chaucer just doesn't really respect his readers?
I don't think so. I don't think he doesn't respect his readers, because I think if he didn't respect his readers, there wouldn't be such metaphor. And I think there's just a lot here that, like, I could really see myself, if I read this when I was in high school, for example, I didn't read any secondary literature. And hell, if I read it the first time, I had actually read The Wife of Bath before you recommended it. And so I had read about it and it was interesting to me, but I would miss the point on a lot of these things.
Well, I think that's what I mean. I don't, not respect so much, but I think he may have thought people, they weren't going to get it.
Yeah, I mean, if this is to be taken that it's all incendiary, you know, that this is supposed to be a send-up, I think things take on a different meaning.
Yeah, I mean, it's perfectly possible. I have to admit that this is all an innocent kind of tale, and it's just sort of put together as a sort of dirty joke. And certainly, you know, there is that school of interpretation that takes Chaucer as kind of being simpler. The main reason why I am kind of trying, you know, think about that this kind of more esoteric kind of allegorical approach might be his actual, what he meant, was that is just that it's such a sustained attack on religion throughout the.
I don't think you could possibly read this in its entirety, even in the translation, and not get that he is giving a message here. I think, I mean, it kind of does. You may not get it all. You may not understand it all at first, but you know enough. You've peaked enough to know, hey, I should be asking some questions about this, because it's like, it is kind of beating you over the head with it, right? So, and I mean, perhaps it's just a sign of the times and if people were very religious, but I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was really a time when people were kind of losing their faith to some extent, and kind of wondering, how can the church be reformed? Can it be reformed? What's the actual core of Christianity? Is there an actual core of Christianity? Stuff like that.
Well, maybe that's an agreed on inroad. That, you know, it's definitely a criticism, because that would be my takeaway, at least through the voices of the characters, specifically the Wife of Bath tale, and what she has to say about, you know, the history of women in the Bible and that kind of thing.
Maybe we should go on to that, because it's
So I'll jumping into her story, you know, the prologue is longer than the tale. I'll describe it briefly. It begins with her saying that she's an authority on marriage because she's had 5 of them since the age of 12. She says that many people have criticized her for having so many husbands, but she gives this kind of long scholastic argument about why it's permitted. She says 3 of the husbands were good, 2 were bad. But what she means by good is that they basically gave her all their money and did whatever she asked. She talks about the good ones were the first 3, the bad ones were the last 2. The 4th husband was like a reveler who had a mistress, and the 4th husband died. And right after she marries this, basically it suggested she had a whatever the male version of a mistress is at the same time, which was like this 20-year-old boy toy named Jenkin.
Yeah, she kept her larder full.
Yeah. So that was the 5th husband. Jenkin turns out to be super misogynistic. He has this big book about how horrible women are that he reads out of, with all these examples like Eve and Delilah. And one evening, out of frustration, the wife tears out pages of the book. Jenkin punches her. As a result, she's deaf in 1 ear. I guess it.
Well, hold on, just to get this a little bit, just to get this a little bit more detailed. She did punch him and knock him into a fire.
Okay, yes, that's fair enough, yes.
Okay, that's all.
And she also admits, during this whole kind of, so to complete the bit about the fight, after she's punched or hit on the side of the head or whatever, she pretends to be dead, and Jenkin is overcome with grief and, you know, goes over her, and she said, please forgive me, please forgive me. And right when he is at his most vulnerable moment, she comes back and gives him her worst punch. And I guess they somehow finally reach a truce after that, where he agrees to give his power and money to her and basically let her do whatever she wants. She, you know, in this kind of prologue, she talks about the techniques supposedly that women use to manipulate men. I think at the same time, she also talks about all the ways that men use to manipulate women in terms of, you know, basically having all these kind of stories, stereotypes about women. And it's kind of this mysterious thing, because it's sort of like, is this like, you know, you could read her 2 ways, right? You could read her as, you know, possibly being a stereotype of, oh yeah, women really are conniving. It's exactly like what Jenkin thinks women are. You could also view her as being pragmatic and like she's saying, this is what women have to do in order to survive and eke out a place for themselves in the world and have any sort of authority and control in order to do what they want. I mean, that what she really seems to be interested in as a human being is having actual authority to choose what happens in her life. Moving on to her tale, the long and the short of it is that it's about this, again, it's a story that happens before Christianity. She says that it was the time of King Arthur's court. One of Arthur's knights goes and just rapes a random woman, and he's brought into court to be killed. As to be executed because of this. Arthur's queen takes pity on him, I guess, and says that, look, we won't kill you, but only if you're able to answer this one question. And the one question is, what do women actually most desire? And Arthur's queen says, okay, you have 1 year to figure this out, and then you have to return. If you're unable to say the right answer, we're going to have to kill you. You're able to say the right answer, you'll be spared. Knight goes and roams out. Everyone has different answers as to what women actually most desire. You know, a year passes by. He comes back on his way back to court. He runs into this old woman who says, I have the answer. I'll only give the answer if you promise to do anything for me. And the knight agrees. So the knight goes back to court with the old woman and gives the answer that the old woman told her. And the answer is, but it's basically the right to choose for themselves, I think.
Power. Power.
Yeah, power. Can't bring it myself to the exact words at this moment. So at that point, what the old woman says is that she wants, in return, you know, the knight has to keep his promise to do whatever she wants. What she wants is for him to marry her. And the knight is like, oh my God, no, it's so bad. I have to marry this old woman. And what it turns out, you know, they have the marriage and they're sitting there on their marriage night. And the old woman's sort of like, okay, now it's time to have sex. And, you know, they're sitting there talking, I guess, in bed or whatever. And the knight kind of explains why he's so sad. It's, you know, because the woman is old and blah, blah, blah. But what he really seems mad about is that she's a low-born woman. And the response, you know, it's a matter of like noble honor that this is a shame upon him, right? And her response is a sort of philosophical argument for why nobility isn't genetic. It's a matter of sort of grace and individual character that, you know, is sort of depends upon the individual and God's grace. She then gives him another choice, which is this. She says, look, I'll give you a choice. I'll either be young and untrue to you, or I'll be old and faithful to you. And the knight finally says, like, look, you are wiser than me. I'm going to let you decide. And she says, because you've given me authority to choose, I'm going to choose to be both young and faithful. And, you know, they all live happily ever after.
Because he gave her the power.
Yeah. So how does all that fit together?
Sorry, the way you put it, it seemed maybe magical. Where I took a reading is that he saw her character, and that was kind of, and then he was blind except for that to her.
Yeah, that might be it. I mean,
that's interesting. I did not get that. I totally thought it was magical.
Okay, I think that's crucial though.
Yeah, right. Me too.
I definitely thought it was magical.
Because if we go, so let me just draw a line to the partner's tale with that. Because the gold that the old man sends the three rioters to find, and ultimately it's their death, seems like a magical proposition. Why would there be so much gold that this person knew about, and that it would, in a metaphysical way, work out to be their end? It seems like a magical thing. It seems like they actually did meet death, and this old man like sent them on a way to find it. There could be other explanations. It could have been some whatever. But in this tale, it seemed to me that it was mirroring the Bat's Wife tale and the Bat's Wife prologue, that it was about a decision to see things a certain way, and with that, a freedom to be in love and faithful. Because the prologue last relationship ended, I'm not sure that that was the bad one, because she argues that, like, while he did, like, hit me, I might have loved him the most. And they did seem, and she was like, I was faithful to him afterwards, after we had that understanding, and he was faithful to me. And that's not something that we would say of that character in the first place with the other husbands, because she wasn't faithful, quote. So if the hag or witch or whatever we want to say that tricked the knight in the story is magical, then that's some kind of moral supernaturalism, you know, that like you can get powers if you play the right rules and give, you know, money to the beggar on the street who turns out to be God and rewards you or whatever.
So, I mean, the way that it happens, what you're saying is actually, okay, so she goes, there's a curtain, she casts up the curtain, or, you know, she tells him to cast up the curtain, so I guess he does so. When the knight saw verily all this, that she so fair was and so young thereto, for joy he had in her arms too, his heart bathed in a bath of bliss. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's true that like technically they don't say that she's young. It's true. I don't know. I mean, maybe it was all a sort of psychological thing or something.
Well,
I don't know.
I would support that just by saying that her arguments were rational. So, yeah. You know, whenever it was talking about, you know, it's not genetic, think about someone who's inherited a lot, he should be virtuous, but then, like, loses the family fortune, like, not virtue, it's, like, shown in action. And, like, yeah, you think I'm dirty, but that's also a good defense against people who, like, want to take advantage of you and, like, you know, not, and, like, see you in a shallow way. So it's like a filter almost, like, it's a choice you're making, and I could clean up if that's what you wanted.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is technically a possible reading. I think that at the end, it is an actual kind of magical thing where she is young and true, and I don't know, and he's changed as well through her rational argument. I mean, I think that, but I obviously.
Yeah, but again, that turns on, you know, that turns the other way if it was some kind of agreement that they saw, you know, that he saw that a character that he could fall in love with, and therefore the scales fall from his eyes or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think a critical thing here is that, you know, he does seem to be improved somewhat in terms of his character, just in the sense that he gives her the choice.
That's an interesting reading, Nathan. I didn't think of it that way. I think it also fits in with the, I think it's at heart, or not at heart, one of the readings is the tale of redemption for this guy, right? Like, it starts with him raping a girl.
Yeah.
It does. And if you take this as a morality tale where a change of consciousness would be the plot, then you have someone who is irredeemable and not concerned with what women desire. And then you can see the like how it plays out. He discovers and gives power to a woman over him, and is that, you know what I mean? Like, there's like a certain kind of like
mathematics for sure here. Yeah, and in a sense, the way that you read it is more powerful, because if it was in fact magic and she was in fact young, it would dull the moral tale that you just mentioned.
Yeah, I actually agree with that. It does kind of dull it when you read it that, you know, when you read it as magical. It feels like I just sort of dismiss it as, oh, you know, that was the way it was at the time, so nobody would be satisfied with a story where she wasn't young and beautiful, because it wouldn't be realistic, and maybe I'm reading too much.
It wouldn't be sexy, perhaps.
Yeah, it's, and so I'm thinking, okay, well, it's magical, but then I think that's interesting. I'm really curious.
Well, I had to restart my computer, and I don't want to open up the tabs again with the PDFs, but I'd like to go in and peruse that. That was just how I took it.
Yeah. So one of the things, I mean, I think what's clearly in the text is that at the very least, the knight perceives her as young and fair, because and when the knight saw verily all of this, that she so fair was, and so young thereto, for joy he had her in his arms too, for his heart bathed in bath of bliss. And so, I mean, he basically does see her. I mean, I don't want to give the knight too much credit. he clearly does see her as being young.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that I didn't like about him, is like, he's just such an ass when he describes, and I wasn't sure if it was the time period, and I'm just thinking, you know, projecting what I imagine now to be a decent man, but the way he's like, oh, I don't like you because you're old and ugly, and she's just sitting there and listening, like, you know,
yeah,
like, okay, thanks for loving me for who I am, thanks for seeing my soul, you're awesome. He totally does not.
Even when he's on his mission, you probably may have mentioned this already, to search out the truth of, you know, what women really want. He like ends up in this town. He's like, oh, sorry, you know, wrong town. Didn't realize I was in the middle of a stupid nowhere. I won't bother you guys. And he wants to leave. And then the old ladies are like, you know, no, might as well stay and ask us. We have some wisdom sometimes. So yeah, he's not an empathetic character at first.
And yeah, he doesn't come up with the answer at all. He's told the answer. And then, right? Isn't that right? He's told the answer and then he just relays it. And then it seems like he's laying on the bed and he's not giving sovereignty, right? He's like, whatever. I do not give a shit. It's going to be sucky either way you decide. That's sort of how it read to me. Not like, you know, you are sovereign and I let you choose. So I don't know if I was just not getting it or if it just read that way to me, but it seemed like wasn't this kind of guy who really was, you know, thinking, oh, she should be sovereign and I'm gonna let her choose. He's like, well, either way sucks, quite honestly. I don't care.
He says, my lady and my love and my wife so dear, I put me in your wise governance. Choose yourself which may be most pleasurable and most honor to you and me also. I do go for us the weather of the two. I don't prefer either of the two, for as you like it sufficeth me.
That's true. That's a little less jerky. I think I just was angry at him because he's saying how old and ugly she was.
Yeah,
it doesn't really match. I don't really get that part, but I don't know if it's just because I'm not understanding the way that men spoke to women during, you know, 1380 or whatever. But it felt a little strange to me to have him confess to his wife why he's unhappy, which is basically a total diss of her.
It is funny in a morbid way, though, because you could see how a knight would think those things. Like, he wouldn't be thrilled.
Well, he would be like, ah. like a Faustian deal. Like, and he was going to die unless he answered a riddle. This is exactly mirrored in the Mel Brooks Robin Hood Men in Tights, where the sheriff is stabbed at the end and dying, and he takes a potion from the witch in order to be alive, but he has to promise one thing, and the promise is that he will marry her. And he's like distraught at the end. So maybe Mel Brooks is a fan of Chaucer, but
he'd rather die than marry a witch or marry an ugly person.
Interesting turn. It's understandable that it's like they've been tricked, and that like this isn't like a willing marriage arrangement. You know what I mean? Like there's been a power dynamic that you know is involved.
And, or is it a commentary on like how men derive their power from women and their subjection of them in a way? Like is there, you know? Is that something that we should be paying attention to? Like,
yeah, I mean, so it's weird because in the prologue, the wife says that this story is about kind of how horrible marriage is. It's an interesting thing to speak of the woe that is marriage. And that seems to be so she has an interesting attitude towards marriage because she, you know, she has these kind of crummy husbands, but she's at the same time nostalgic for the two bad husbands to some extent. She speaks of the woe that is marriage, but she wants apparently a sixth husband now. It's like, you know, and then at the end of her tale, she basically says, you know, I pray to Jesus that our husbands are given short lives and that we'll outlive them. And that for the, you know, husbands that don't give us, you know, all their money, that God send them pestilence. Whereas her tale kind of, I think like the optimistic reading of her tale is sort of like what's critical in to make a marriage work is that like there's this paradoxical thing that has to happen where both people kind of give each other authority.
Yeah, I think that was sort of the point of, that I got to was that it's not just that the women have the power, but that the men cede the power to the women, that they give the power over willingly. And that was sort of the point.
Yeah. And the thing is that at the end, it also says that she obeyed him in everything exactly. As well. And that there's a sense of that somehow there has to be some sort of reciprocal kind of giving. But then she comes back and says, oh, dear Jesus, actually, we want, you know, husbands to give us everything. Right. And what I think her perspective, it's like the tale is sort of like an ideal, like it has an ideal at the end of maybe what marriage should be. But I think she's too realistic. You know, she knows that that's kind of not exactly how things are, that there really is like a power dynamic. And ultimately, like you need to win that dynamic if you're going to have a place for yourself in the world as a woman.
Yeah, well, I think, it, you know, maybe crucially what the answer that she gave. That was accurate to all the women present, including the queen in the story, was that women wanted power over their men.
So but I mean, I think it's...
Go, yeah, please go ahead, Lauren.
What jumps out at me is the power dynamic, or it's something that has to be given to them. Like, we go back to like, that whole idea, which I guess you guys, or maybe Jennifer brought up, that both parties having the authority. It seems like in the way this plays out in this tale, in maybe throughout the whole Canterbury Tales, is that women want the power, but it has to be given to them. Like, men automatically have it.
Well, I think I was pointing out more of the idea of power being given versus getting power by force or getting power by taking it.
Well, okay, yeah.
So I don't know. I thought that was an interesting thing because there's the – we didn't read The Shipman's Tale. Did you?
Yeah.
Did anybody read The Shipman's Tale?
What happens in it? I forget.
So The Shipman's Tale is a story about, like, I'm going to butcher it, but I'm just remembering. So there's, like, a woman, and she's having, like, a relationship with a person besides her husband. She asks him for, like, $100, let's just say, because it's not that, but whatever, it's money. And then he goes to her husband and says, can I borrow $100? And then I guess when the husband asks for the money back, the wife says... Or the guy says, you know, oh, I gave that $100 to your wife. And then the wife says, oh, I'm so sorry, I spent it all on dresses. Do you remember that story?
Yeah.
So there's so there's another story that was existing during that time, which another person wrote. And it's like, apparently he would have definitely known that this person wrote the story. But in this story, when the man gives her the $100, the person she's having sex with, he basically takes the $100 and says, I will have sex with you if you give me this $100. And in the original story, the story the other guy told, there's a third party in the room, so that basically the woman can't get out of how she got of getting the money and having the money from the guy. But he never says that's why. It's not said, oh, I'm going to give this woman $100 for having sex. But I guess the point being that in that story, the woman is
she doesn't have the power in that story. And, you know, the not the one that this guy wrote, not the one Chaucer wrote, because she does. She's kind of got some power, but it's like power that she's sort of taken, and she's, I don't know, it's different in the sense that, you know, she says, oh, I went and spit it on pretty dresses. She's not really fully in control, but she's a little bit better off than the original story of the guy that the guy wrote during that time period, in which the woman has absolutely no power.
Yeah.
Right. Because she's kind of held accountable by this third party that saw that he gave her the money and said, this is to pay your husband back, or something along those lines. I'm really butchering it. I'm sorry. I didn't think we were going to discuss this. Point being that, you know, the way in which she has the power is, I think, important. And I wondered if it was something like, I wonder what Chaucer was trying to say by saying, you know, that she got the power in a way that wasn't sort of underhanded or taking it, or
I don't actually look, in any event. So okay, let's go back to the wife of Bath. I kind of don't have any memory of the Shipman's Tale, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, that's okay. Well, you know what? I'm unfortunately going to have to go in a few minutes. So I don't know if you want to skip on to the Partner's Tale, or if we should just finish this one, or.
All right. Do people want to continue this on, or just want to.
And just do favorite lines.
Yeah. Actually, I just had two words I liked out of the Partner's Tale. It was referring to the devil's clay.
Oh, wow. Cool. Well, yeah. And I have one out of Wife of Bath, which is probably pretty obvious. Women don't love a man who watches so closely.
Which one is it? Oh my God, that's it.
Women don't love a man who watches so closely. We need to be free. We need to make our own choices. Yes. Which is very, very current. Very of today.
Yes, and that is in the translated version.
It's in the translated version, but even so, it's very of today. And reflects the conflict that we see throughout these tales, or at least this tale, about, Chaucer's position as a feminist, as a misogynist, as a, you know, who knows what. And I think that goes to that he wants to keep you guessing. He wants to keep the reader guessing. And that also plays into my statement before, which is that maybe he doesn't have respect for his readers, but I don't think I was right in that, but rather that he's not going to give it all out easily. He's going to make you work.
I cannot give last line because she stole mine.
So my last line is just, you know, we didn't get into the Partner's Tale, so it's going to be out of context, but it's the old man in the Partner's Tale that is apparently cursed by God to live forever. In a sort of strange inversion of the Christian afterlife, rather than in heaven, you have to live forever on earth. I find it very eerily reminiscent of the actual fate of the universe, in the sense of it'll just seems like our best guess is that it just seems to go on and on and on for longer than anyone can possibly imagine. And the thing that he says, for I can not find a man, though I walked into Indy, neither in city nor in village, that would change his youth for mine age. Basically, God's man is basically like, you need to find someone who would exchange their youth for your old age, which is not human nature. And I think it's a strange thing. I mean, this is some sort of reference to Christ, that Christ, Christian belief system, like, dies for us as a fairly young man as well. It's, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting curse that, and a sort of weird inversion of Christ, that this guy that he's trying to find that doesn't exist is sort of like Christ, basically, like, mm-hmm. but like an earthly Christ, that, and such an earthly Christ doesn't exist. In any event, what I'm trying to get at, I actually, if we could have gotten into the Partner's Tale, I do think that there is actually like a religious impulse here, but it's very much bound in this, in these sort of weird inversions of Christian belief that he has.
But wait, I have to say something. I chose the wrong line, so you can have my line.
Oh, good. Well, I like that one. Okay. Yeah,
yeah. No, my my line actually was from the Wife of Bath. Christ was a virgin, but shaped like a man.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. So I think that's, it was around the time when they were talking about how, like, men have parts and they want to use their parts, and right. Like, everybody has these impulses, men have these impulses, and then he's like, okay, so he was a virgin, but still, he was shaped like a man. He must have impulses too, or something along those lines.
No, because they talk about it. He says at one point, I want to be able to have as much fun as Jesus did, or, you know, or as Christ did. And I was
he was talking about Solomon. He wanted to have as much fun as the guy. Was it,
oh, maybe it was Solomon. You're right.
It was
right.
The guy who married a bunch of women and, like, had sex with
them all. Right. The other thing I wanted to say that jumped out at me for some reason when we were going over the general prologue this time, I don't know why it didn't jump out at me before, was the beginning of the general prologue when April arrives and with his sweetened showers drenches dried up roots gives them power. It jumped out at me. Beginning lines of The Wasteland, April is the coolest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. And I was, wait a minute, Chaucer, Canterbury's Tale starts with April. Anyway, yeah, I didn't
notice that. It's a reference.
Yeah.
The Wasteland, that's a reference.